Today, we are interviewing and speaking to an amazing, amazing thinker, amazing social intellectual who is a writer and a communication specialist. Her name is Lazola Kati. Okay? She's leading a movement that has been developed by Fossil Free SA, an organization. She is the ad campaign manager there. And the main campaign that she headed up is called FAB, which stands for the Fossil Ad Ban, which, similar to the tobacco, is calling for anti-whitewashing, legally speaking, and anti-greenwashing in terms of marketing and promotion, where companies that are polluting the earth and that are ramping up fossil production, okay, or the fossil value chain, go around claiming that they are green or sustainable when it's not true. I was really moved by Lazola. Look, I can say a lot about her, but I think I just want to get to something that really moved me about her that you can benefit from this episode, is that she led a campaign that actually resulted in a ruling, right? A regulatory ruling. Okay. And this campaign went out of its way to show and demonstrate that Total Energies, you usually see them, the petroleum sellers on the side of the highway. I mean, I've certainly pulled fuel in my car from Total Energies. You know, so I don't want to pretend to be a saint here. So I know them very well. But, you know, this ruling that came out recently demonstrated that their claims in their adverts that they are sustainable or pro-green was factually misleading. Lazola Kati has appeared in many of our leading media outlets. I'm talking The Mail and Guardian. I'm talking Cape Talk, News 24. I'm talking Financial Times. I'm talking Business Day, The Daily Maverick, okay, Sunday World. All right. And her work, this FAB, fossil ad ban campaign, got so far that it even reached the South African Parliament and was endorsed by a political party that is in the African Parliament as part of their policy outlooks. This woman is a force to be reckoned with. Her work leads to policy adoption. Her work leads to regulatory judgments that prove unequivocally that these companies are misleading the public. She is not just the type of person that lifts a placard or goes on strike or leads an action movement. The work she does, okay, forces these people to tell the truth. She speaks truth to power in journalistic terms. I met her at a conference, and she was the only one speaking about these issues, social media, digital misinformation. And I felt that she would be an absolutely, absolutely great guest. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Lazola Kati.
Welcome aboard our jet. The Just Energy Transition is a new podcast with the goal of amplifying the stories that matter most. Our mission? A Just Energy Transition, raising the voices of untold inspiring stories. At JET, we hope every listener becomes a true activist and every story a catalyst for real change.
Welcome to the JET, the Just Energy Transition podcast. We are so happy to have you on.
And you are representing fossil-free South Africa as a campaigns ad manager. What campaigns are you working on currently?
So I lead the fossil ad ban campaign. The campaigns we're currently working on. So it's an overall campaign that basically advocates for a fossil ad ban in South Africa, right? So that's just the general, or rather bigger overarching goal. And this is the bigger campaign. So recently we launched our first report, which is the first greenwashing report in South Africa. That is one campaign that we're working on, which is the research element of greenwashing. Because that's what we work in. Fossil ad ban is pushing for an ad ban, but most specifically an expanded definition of greenwashing, right? Our next campaign is basically looking at including municipalities, national and municipal policymakers into passing an ad ban law. So, for lack of a better word, lobbying these policymakers into it. And third, we've got the campaign also focuses on bringing in civil society and community members into understanding greenwashing, how it plays out, and also how communities and civil society can be better prepared, right, for greenwashing from fossil fuel companies. So one of the recent things that we did is that we went to Mpumalanga. The community is surrounded by 42 mines. It's one of the it's the community in South Africa that's hardest hit by mining, and specifically coal mining. It's the community of Carolina.
What community is that?
In Mpumalanga. Yeah. So this community has been the hardest hit. It's got over 42 mines, a couple of gold mines as well. So you can imagine the level of struggle and strife that these community members face. And the reason we went there is to kind of understand how greenwashing works on the ground, right? Because we speak about greenwashing on a surface level as fossil fuel companies not actually disclosing the full damage that they do when it comes to environment, right? And this obviously affects public perception, social licensing. It also affects policymakers and how many sort of policies can be passed against fossil fuel companies. So we thought, instead of just having a high-level conversation at your thematic areas, academia, and policymakers, let's look and speak to the people on the ground that are actually affected by greenwashing. So what are the greenwashing claims, or what are the greenwashing scripts that fossil fuel companies deliver to communities so that they can have social licensing to actually implement mining and to start their projects? And I mean, the results were staggering. So that's basically what we do and how far the campaign has gone.
Before we get into the results, in everything you've just said, you have dropped a wealth of information. So I want us to unpack this a little bit before we go on to the results, you know, these staggering results, because I think it'll be great for our audience and for me to hear what these results were and how you intend to combat them. So first things first, the campaign is called BAD, which is the fossil ad BAD, okay? And the aim of the campaign is to push for an ad ban on greenwashing at the policy level. So this is not at the level of organization. This is at the policy level. Who acts as the at the policy level? You mentioned municipalities, but they don't really drive. They don't really create policies, right? So who are you targeting?
Municipalities play an important role in South Africa when it comes to passing policies. So they're definitely the first tier that we need to kind of speak into, specifically because other countries like the Netherlands that have passed fossil ad bans, you find that starting it at a municipal level is best. But we are also targeting national government. We're targeting the Minister of Environmental Forestry and Fisheries in South Africa. We are targeting the President of South Africa to say, listen, I mean, at the very least, the UN Secretary General has said countries need to start passing laws to stop greenwashing. So where are you on this? And we have a proposed law, and we have municipalities and different political parties that support and have taken resolutions on this. So let's get a fossil ad ban in South Africa, you know?
Okay, so why is the precedent? So if the UNSG has said this, and South Africa is a member of the UN, and if countries like the Netherlands have already done it, we have a precedent, we have a benchmark. Why is it still difficult to get through to South African policy?
The thing is that greenwashing is an important tactic for fossil fuel companies to succeed. And what we
let me stop you there. What is greenwashing, Lazo?
Greenwashing is basically an advertising tactic that a lot of fossil fuel companies use to make themselves look more environmentally friendly. They do this. The limited definition tells us about making environmental claims, like in an advert or any engagement that they have. They will say, we support sustainable development. We support environmental protection. An example was Total funding South African national parks for, I think they've had a partnership for over 60 years. So fossil fuel companies then can go ahead and say, hey, well, Total Energies has gone ahead and said, we have funded sand parks for over 60 years. Therefore, we are for protection of the environment and we are for sustainable development. But the flip side to this, which was proven through our greenwashing campaign, the first one in South Africa, and we won, is that you can support that, but your primary business of the day is actually necessitating for sand parks to get additional funding to save the environment. So your primary business is that of coal and oil and petroleum. That actually nullifies you from saying you are protecting the environment or you are for sustainable development, because how, right? So that's what greenwashing is, and that's how it plays out.
Mm. So greenwashing is a ruse. It's a front that companies use, and they advertise themselves as being pro just transition, being pro sustainable development, being pro green economy, circular economy, whereas their main primary mode of business is against this. So it's kind of like a criminal who goes to church and donates their money at church to pay for their sins. So I hear you, and so this is a very important concept, and so what is the mainstream definition of green washing? I mean, like, as in the definition you would write on paper, right, when you're communicating, versus the lack of a definition in South Africa that you're talking about.
Greenwashing is the process of companies making themselves making themselves seem like they are for environmental or the just transition. And this is inclusive of wording. This is inclusive of imagery. This is inclusive of spaces and also CSI projects. So currently, it only includes environmental claims. So we're pushing for an expansion for imagery, where the images are, and also the CSI projects, because these are the three categories that these companies mainly use. I don't think that there is a Shell BP Total Energies advert that just plays and everyone's kind of like squinting their eyes to see the T's and C's at the bottom, right? No one's doing that. What we're seeing in these adverts is Shell sort of displaying solars and wind turbines, and they are displaying a sort of techno salvation images, like scientists, and telling us that we're pushing for a better tomorrow, a green tomorrow. That's what we're seeing. And we're saying that greenwashing, the definition and the criteria should move into that as well. This will then make policies that govern greenwashing in a country be basically more available, and also more available for use when it comes to combating greenwashing.
Okay, so you mentioned three things there: imagery, wording, and corporate social responsibility. or corporate social investment, CSR, CSI. Now, I can get the wording part. I can get the wording, how you can manipulate your words to make something seem like what it isn't. But imagery, for an example, if this gangster goes to the church and has one of those, you know, those parades,
yes,
where they hold this big check, yeah, you know, this big check, and this gangster donates this money to the church and has this big ceremony check with the ribbon and fireworks and everything, and confetti. Is that a lie? Is this a lie? So with imagery, you know, if Shell takes a drone and puts it in the air and takes pictures of solar panels on their operations, they're greenwashing. The panels are there. The panels are working. How is the gangster greenwashing? He or she, you know, godmother or godfather donated the money. Yes. They really did.
That's brilliant.
So how is this greenwashing?
And then the issue here is representation. Greenwashing is not necessarily, it's omitting information to create a perception. It is not sort of like lying explicitly. So currently we're looking at explicit environmental claims, which say when they lie, when they say, oh yes, we have solar panels at our plant, but they actually don't. What we're saying is that the imagery counts. So the gangster standing there with a big check and confetti saying, I want this church to develop so that we can build the community because I want the community to grow, right? That's what the gangster's saying with that imagery, right? But what the gangster's saying with the money that made, that the money that, or the actions that made that money is that, listen, I'm selling drugs, I'm making money, and I don't care who dies. And that's what the fossil fuel companies are doing, is that, and also when you look at the figures, it's such a small amount that actually goes into renewable energy. It's a small amount of the money that they make and a small amount of their budget. Just recently with the report, we collected just 2 months of data. 2 months of data when it comes to how much they spent, top six fossil fuel companies in South Africa, how much they spent on marketing. These people in 2 months spent over 15 million rand on marketing, collectively, yes.
Collectively.
And then they reached over 30.5 million people. And the report actually stipulates each of, and we look and we analyze each of these fossil fuel companies have an advert where they were greenwashing. The whole tactic is greenwashing. That means 30.5 million people were exposed to greenwashing and 15.2 million plus was spent on greenwashing, right? And that's just 2 months. Now, if you can collate 12 years, you can call it 100 years of Total Energies in Africa, how much would you get? Would that not be enough for actual investment into renewable energy instead of trying to say we support environmental protection? So that's what we're saying.
I see what you're saying. I mean, that has really clarified. By the way, where can this report be found if anybody is curious about finding this report? Just briefly before we continue our conversation.
The Smokes and Mirrors report is on Fossil Free SA, the website. So www.fossilfree.org.za. It's on all our social media platforms, the Fossil Free SA Instagram page. And we're going to be sending out to media because we actually launched it last week on Wednesday. So we're workshopping it out to media. We do have some heavy media outlets that had attended the report launch. So people can find it online. If you literally type Smokes and Mirrors report on Google, it will pop up from our website and our social media platforms. Fresh.
So it's fresh. I like that. I like the way you do your analyses. So let me see if I've got this. So the greenwashing is not the godfather or godmother saying I donated this amount of money to the church, because that is a fact. It is them saying, It is the reasons that they give for that donation. So if they say I donated this again because I believe this particular religion message gives values to the youth. It gives good values of development and love and care. Whereas they are, as you know, I like your example of maybe illicit drugs that are dangerous. Whereas they are selling these drugs to the youth, and causing the youth to go buck wild and to be ruckus. So I get you. So now in the case of the gangster, the fact that they are not arrested is that there's no evidence of them doing this. We may know this, but there is no evidence. So how do you get the evidence that an organization is going contra to the particular claim they're making in an ad?
For you to be a criminal, for you to have done something, you need to have gone against a law. Law is born of a policy, right? Now, in the absence of that, we can't say you killed someone. Nobody knows. Let's say, for instance, before there were laws on killing people, right? We don't know that based on this evidence, you have broken this law. Now, in the absence of a greenwashing policy, we can't say you have broken this, say, oh, that's horrible, and we can keep it moving.
I understand why now you are advocating for policy changes, or for the government to recognize greenwashing and to have a clear definition of greenwashing. Do you think the existing definition, does the United Nations have a definition?
They do. And it's relatively also limiting. But they do kind of look at, you know, how the United Nations is always encouraging people to do better. So the encouragement word from the United Nations is, okay, countries do better. But it still is not an expanded version like we are speaking about from the United Nations.
And what about the Netherlands? Did they give a definition that you think is sufficient?
They did. More than anything, so their definition is clear, but their sanctions include things like your imagery. They actually, and it's at a municipal level. It's just, so even the recent one that was passed through the city of Hague, their actions actually speak to imagery. They speak to billboards. Like, you cannot advertise on fossil fuels on billboards in certain areas. So at least that definition speaks to the needs of the country. Because remember, we can have an expanded definition, but it must be country specific. And we're the global south, which is why we are pushing. Otherwise, we could have said, hey, South Africa, do what the Netherlands is doing. But we need to, if we are going to have a just transition that is just and that is honest, we need to create and set precedents that are from the global south, as the global south.
So give me an example. You know, when we talk global north, global north, as in developed Western countries versus the global south, which is developing or emerging countries, what would be the difference there? Because from where I'm standing, advertising is advertising. Heineken advertising in the Netherlands, it would be largely similar to Heineken advertising in South Africa. So what is the difference there that requires the nuance in our definition and approach?
I mean, the nuance is quite big. Because the truth of the matter is, when having these conversations, we can't run away from the access of the global south to information. We cannot run away from the fact that the global south tapped onto this conversation pretty late. In the 1970s, scientists were speaking to Total Energies in France and America to say, listen, you guys are perpetuating global warming. And only we are still saying global warming. There are still the majority of the global south that don't know global warming, then the climate crisis, then things like greenwashing and the just transition. So the bigger issue here is access to information. That's why it also has to be nuanced. Two, the first world countries have a grasp on the technology, the manufacturing technology that is needed to switch to renewables. That tells you how far they are versus us, who are still saying, can you give us loans for electricity access in the instance of South Africa?
There are countries like the Netherlands have already switched to a majority renewables energy sort of economy. Green economies are words that are still coming up in the global south. So when we come up with our policies or when we speak, we cannot reach up. And if we are going to truly have a just transition, it needs to look like us, sound like us, and benefit us. Hence the conversations on reparations is also coming in.
Okay, so this is now twofold. So we would be trying to address this issue domestically, internally, but at the same time, you said we cannot look up, as in we cannot use benchmarks and precedents that are being used in the global north, because if I'm understanding you correctly, you can be harsher in the global north on what greenwashing is because they have access to technology to actually not do it. So it would be ignorance. They would be playing ignorance, whereas they have alternative means. So in the case of the global south and looking at South Africa, where Fossil Free SA operates, we are still struggling to find or resource the just energy transition. Wouldn't that be an argument against your endeavors? Wouldn't that then kind of be a leeway for companies here to say, well, we are still developing. You are talking about things we don't have access to. Wouldn't that be an argument for more leniency in this context?
It wouldn't be, because the fossil fuel companies, the majority of them that operate in this country are foreign, right? Total Energies that we're speaking about is in France. Mm. These companies are not from South Africa. Therefore, the limitations that we are speaking about are not for them. They don't face these limitations, right? They do have the technology to switch to renewables energy. They do have the know-how, expertise, and the teams to actually advertise honestly and not greenwash themselves. That is definitely not an argument for leniency at all. But it is a recognition of the limits that the global south has and the amount of volume of work that civil society and allies in the just transition still has to do, including governments. And that probably would be for governments to do more. But for the fossil fuel companies, definitely, absolutely not. I think companies like Total Energies have been in the continent for over 100 years. And that's in Africa. Mm-hmm. And they've operated elsewhere as well. So there is a clear understanding of what they're doing and what they shouldn't be doing, even in the countries. But again, because of the lack of policies that govern them, they can just run willy-nilly. They can just keep going.
Mm, that is such an awesome distinction there. What you're saying basically is that these companies abide by these principles and laws in their home countries where they're headquartered. Yet when they come to, and their home countries are largely in the global north, okay, Western Europe, etc., North America, but when they come to the global south, like South Africa, they relax in a sense. They relax. They don't apply the same principles. Now, what you typically have going on in the global south is that global south country governments argue that we need this foreign direct investment. We need these companies. You know, we have this begging bowl, right? We need them. If we're too harsh on them, they will just pull out their operations. An example with South Africa is Volkswagen, right? We had a Volkswagen plant that was producing lots of BMWs and VW cars and vehicles. And the moment we started, our society started asserting the need for greater dignity and greater respect of our workers, they simply pulled out and left. And all those workers were left without jobs. And so we have a situation where the government says, well, do you want your jobs or not? or do you want your rhetoric and your narrative? So what would you say in response to this this pushback?
You've got your jobs and your lives, because the statistics show in South Africa the hard hitting impact of environmental change and the climate crisis. A good example, just last year, a search or study was released that basically stated in Upper KZN, in the heated areas of one of the provinces, there are increased miscarriages because of the globe actually warming up. So that's one. Two, we've got community like the Carolina community that has over 42 mines, coal mines surrounding it, and some gold and some gold mines. That province is predominantly agricultural based. And that means in terms of jobs, that means in terms of food and survival. And when you have over 42 mines, what you're getting is the men and the boys going to work in the mines, dying in the mines, families never getting any money back, compensation, anything. The women are also going to work in the mines, and the same type of situation is happening. We have jobs that are actually being destroyed in the thousands because mines are essentially destroying the environment. Mines are dumping. Mines are opening and shutting from Chinese companies and French companies and English companies. And no one's ever asking the communities, how can we work better with you? We have promises that we will employ the community members in the mine that we're opening up. So you can see the environmental and human degradation that's happening, even in the labor sector, right? This is why We haven't spoken about the respiratory issues that South Africans are facing. And this is, a conversation in the broader global world, right? And these are the effects of climate change. These are the effects of these fossil fuel companies. So what the government should be asking, if they're honest, they should be saying, so you've got your jobs or your lives. It's either you die or you work, right? And which one is a human being going to pick, right? And two, the government can say this, but the truth of the matter is, and this goes into theory, right? How the global south interacts with the global north, right? We go in baking with our bowls. But the truth of the matter is, these companies need our resources for their industrialization to keep moving, right? And honestly, South Africa sits at a very privileged position in terms of negotiating in diplomacy and foreign policy. Right. A good example is what happened between South Africa, the USA, Trump recently, and BRICS. We are actually in a good position.
What happened?
So
what
basically happened? When South Africa, it was actually started with the court case when South Africa brought to the ICC that basically what is happening in Gaza should actually stop. There should be a ceasefire. That started a ripple effect with America kind of facing South Africa and saying, okay, there's an issue with this country. Moved on recently to one of our political parties, shamefully, going all the way to America to say a new bill that was passed to address land issues of the past and heritage rights is actually willy-nilly taking land away from farmers. And then Trump came back to say, actually, we will place sanctions on South Africa, because South Africa is doing bad things and they're treating their people horribly and these mass genocide of farmers, right? And the ripple effect that has not been what the US has expected, right? South Africa is still standing. Our president came out and said, listen, you look at your issues and we'll look at our issues. This shows the diplomatic strength of South Africa, because after then, China increased their tariffs on liquefied gas and oil to America, right? We had a ripple again of different, even England coming out to say, listen, and this was also because South Africa then supported the DRC. It also came into play. And America then obviously funds Rwanda. This is public information. And the attention was created between South Africa and the US. But the response was not South Africa backing down. When South Africa backed up, instead of backing down, other countries stepped forward and we could hold our ground, right? And when I think that South Africa is in a better condition to negotiate, these are just a few examples, right? So there is no need like South Africa that is in coalitions with other global South countries to say, oh, please,
continue to invest in our country. We are choosing as a country to negotiate from that perspective.
And we are not going to market this organization that went all the way to America. So I'm not going to say their names, but suffice it to say that this is an organization that is not complaining about the mass genocide that has occurred in apartheid and its effects that are continuing to bring about corporate and economic genocide, like you're saying, when workers die in mines, when communities around mines die because of diseases contracted. So they are concerned, they are in themselves yeah. greenwashing, calling it mass genocide when they know themselves are advocates for perspectives and positions that are genocidal yeah. in principle. Now, for our sake here, given what you've said about the strength we have and the support that BRICS is giving us, and even some of the global North countries that are that are feeling guilty and want to compensate for their past harms, like the UK and England as such. So what happens when you, Lazola, approach policymakers? Tell us who these policymakers are. We're going to come back to the municipalities, but at the highest level, who are the policymakers you are approaching, and what do they say to you in light of these possibilities that are actually available to them?
I mean, the truth of the matter is Global South governments and South African government is filled with fairly senior people. So some of these concepts that we are talking about are fairly new, right? So there is an information gap, and that is something we must just be honest about, right? We are approaching different political parties that sit in parliament and that can actually assist us in getting this passed and lobbying other political parties. So one of the political parties, which I will mention, we have approached is the Good Party. And they had a very good sort of like energy transition policy that they had adopted in their conference before the national elections that happened. And this is why we had started with them. And they actually got on board. They got on board and they're like, we are supporting the ad ban. We are supporting for there to be an ad ban in South Africa. And they came to our report launch, and they've also been outright in terms of what more can we do. So there is a partnership with that. There is also allowance within these partnerships to build a movement of political parties that will support this, so we can take it to the relevant department in South Africa, because you can't just approach the Minister of Environment, Fisheries and Forestry, unfortunately, in South Africa and say, hey, we've got a policy, you should support this, right? Regardless of the fact that that same minister belongs to a political party, the opposition political party, that took a resolution on greenwashing on their 2023 conference, right? So, Abhijit, we are speaking to political parties, but the truth of the matter is there's an information gap. And those that passed these resolutions as support, as though they support the resolutions, you find that either memory loss or they get into the into leadership positions, and it's difficult to move with the resolution. We're not quite sure what the issue is there. But when we do approach policymakers, they are interested in having a further conversation on ad ban. It is a new concept, for one. And number two, it is a matter of mapping out how do we get this as a policy, and how do we get it passed in South Africa to speak to South Africans without also for some, obviously, we are expecting them to say without causing tensions with foreign investment. But obviously, there will be tensions. I mean, this conversation we've had has proven that. But policymakers thus far have been fairly interested in a fossil ad ban.
Okay. So I hear what you're saying. And I think this is really critical for civil society organizations in this space. It is not as impactful to approach incumbent leaders in national government departments, like ministers, director generals, because they are subordinate to existing policy and they cannot necessarily change those policies. What is the best tactic, if I'm hearing you carefully, is to hit directly the center of policymaking, such as Parliament, where these policies are introduced and passed. I know there are different committees in Parliament to address different issues. Do we have a committee on just energy and environmental protection? Do we have one in the South African Parliament?
I guess we do. But the truth of the matter is, as seen when the climate change bill was passed, civil society and external policymakers also just kind of looked at that policy and said, okay, we need to do better, right? So the truth of the matter is that not much is being done. There are different committees that exist within different departments that are trying to address the just transition. We've also got the Presidential, I think, Climate Coalition. It's also in existence. Yeah.
Yes.
So there are the energy department. I forget the minister's name, but he's fairly new. It's a new department that was meant to address electricity cutouts in South Africa. But they are also trying to address energy issues. But what we don't have is a coalition that includes civil society, includes communities, includes policymakers, and puts us around a table. And owing, and I mean, a lot of that is owing to representative politics, but also it is a lack because we can't necessarily have a just transition. A good example for this would have been, we wouldn't be involved in activities like Africa Energy Week, where it is actually exclusionary in terms of economic stance to have civil society or communities. Just last, when we had Africa Energy Week last year, the tickets were $4,000. That's 72,000 Rand. That tells you who's meant to be there, not meant to be there. Mm-hmm. So if we had an effective coalition that included all three aspects, that all three people that I listed, then I don't believe we would be where we are in terms of the just transition, where the majority of the community of the country, there's not a thorough understanding of what the just transition is. What does it look like when it's just, when we're not talking about access, when we're not talking about reparations, when we're not talking about fair finance, when we're not talking about inclusion? So how is it just? So that's also the issue that faces South Africa in terms of addressing, or rather honestly and effectively participating and creating a just transition.
Very powerful. So you're not just facing a stumbling block in the sense that the parliamentary representatives in favor of the just energy and just environmental transition as such are not the majority, so they're the minority and often not listened to. But you are also facing an issue where fossil and carbon derived energy producers are tactfully and strategically excluding civil society organizations like yourself by pricing ridiculous amounts to access certain fora where these things are discussed, and, you know, having quite limited, you know, representation in the, like, Presidential Climate Commission, for an example. So I hear you. I get you. And another thing that you're mentioning here is that some of the individuals that are pro these, you know, this just energy position end up being given or, you know, hushed by high positions in government. Okay, so you have this machinery, okay, against you, and I'm going to make a point here that I want to make very clear to the listeners is not coming from La Zola, and it is not a fossil free South Africa position. But I would argue that our President Cyril Ramaphosa, having been the chairperson of Lonmin when we had the Marikana massacre is a greenwasher in this sense when we talk about justice in South Africa. And another issue that I want to come into here that I want to pivot, which again is not Lazola's view and it is not fossil free South Africa's view, is that Cyril Ramaphosa, our president, was chair of South African breweries when the issue of alcohol advertising bans was raised. Now, I can say this. I was very close with somebody who was a sales representative for South African breweries. In fact, not just a sales rep. He was a regional manager, okay, for sales for South African breweries, right, which is an alcohol production company. So, and his job was to sell alcohol, right? That was his job. And we would have conversations about this when this issue became a nationally mainstream, and we almost got to the point where alcohol advertising was banned. And, you know, me and him spoke on the phone and, you know, he said, Tux, people sometimes call me Tux because my surname is Takati. And he said, Tux, this is, that thing is not going to happen, bro. That thing is not going to happen. I'm speaking to all my managers. They say it's just talk, to make the government look good, but it's not going to happen because there's too much money, in alcohol advertising. So, do you have any reflections on that? I mean, if we failed as a nation, where we have such high levels of alcohol consumption, killing our youth, killing our even our elders, affecting our communities, we have evidence of the impact of excessive alcohol consumption. And this idea of making alcohol look cool to teenagers and young people. So, you know, there we have solid evidence and yet we failed. You know, my good friend he said, my sales are going nowhere, chief. They're going nowhere. Don't worry. We're just massaging the government and the public to make them believe that we're serious. So if we failed, we have a precedent there. If we failed with something that has so much evidence of negative impact, what do you think we are up against in the case of greenwashing?
I mean, we're up against a lot. We're up against a lot because what we're pushing for is something like the tobacco ban, and that took eons. That took eons. And the truth of the matter is we're up against, I like what you said, where we're up against the machinery, right? A well-oiled machine that has its own way of running, and things like greenwashing are just like kind of sticks that in their minds, it's kind of sticks that's being thrown at a machine, which is why it's important to have a different approach. Which is why our approach has been that of not just lobbying. Like, civil society knows this, right? The best we can do is continue to engage civil society, and we can collaborate in launching greenwashing complaints, because currently ours was the first one in South Africa, meaning it was the first victory. It's the landmark victory. At least there's a precedent set there, right?
So we launched
South Africa's first greenwashing complaint with the South African Advertising Regulatory Body, right? And that was tough and grueling. And this speaks to the lack of platforms. Even if you know greenwashing is happening, but where can you go? It speaks to the lack of platforms, because even the complaint system with that advertising body, it did not, in fact, before we launched the complaint, to have a greenwashing complaint, because there's no precedent set. The platform in and of itself needed us to go in, kind of read, call the members of the or people that sit within the advertising regulatory body of South Africa to understand that, listen, we have this complaint, this is the evidence we have, and it was against Total Energies and the Sandparks partnership, and we want to launch a complaint. And then I tell you, it took months and months and months. That is it, because there's no facility for it, right? So this is the kind of
machinery we are up against. Even the relative, or yes, the relative platforms where you can launch complaints simply don't cater for greenwashing complaints, right? So this is why our tactics in terms of speaking to policymakers are important, and not just shooting through to national government and saying, pass this law, because we do have a past. We do have a reputation of not walking the talk, of workshopping, but not walking the talk, right? Your friend said, this thing is not going to be passed, and it was never passed. We still have ads that are going on everywhere on alcohol. We're still glorifying alcohol. It's in music, it's in popular culture, social media, it's on all platforms, right? So this is why a tactic that does not just shoot through, but brings in all affected parties and interested parties and transforms those that are not interested at policy level is important. Because then in that way, we bring together a comprehensive policy to say, this is what we're all saying, and not just fossil-free South Africa.
Very powerful. What an inspirational victory. First and foremost, when you say months and months and months, what are we talking about here? A year? How long did it take for you to gain this victory?
It took over 7 months, because the Fossil Ad Ban campaign was founded in 2022, when it was a bit operational in 2023, and we launched our complaint late 2023, or rather we started consultation with legal experts on, can we actually launch this type of complaint? Will it hold water? And then we went to the advertising regulatory body to say, we need help. Your facilities actually don't speak to this. And they were forthcoming in terms of saying, actually, we're working on a policy that will allow for environmental complaints to actually come in, because we've identified this problem. So it took over 7 months, because then we got what you would call a victory in 2024 around June. And then Total Energies launched an appeal process, basically to say that because the original ruling from the regulatory body basically stated that Total Energies was not supposed to say they support sustainable development, but they do support environmental protection because they are in this partnership with Sandbox. And through actually the appeal that Total launched, that helped us, because then what came from that is basically fossil-free South Africa and the marketing team from Total Energies actually presenting both their cases. And here is where, honestly, loggerheads happened, because the previous complaint was just being reviewed and we get given the response. But we had to just submit written responses. Here, we were having it out. And from that then conversation, or rather hearing, we got a full victory where it said, the ruling stated that by virtue of the fact that your primary business is in the fossil fuel industry, you cannot claim that you are protecting the environment or sustainable development. And your partnership with Sandparks does not count. That is the victory we were looking for. That is the proof we were looking for, to say your partnership is a small fraction. And mind you, a lot of these partnerships are actually, they have to participate. Fossil fuel companies have to participate in these partnerships for tax. They also have to. So it's not like, oh, from the goodness of our heart, we are donating or we are supporting. It's not. You see? So that was the landmark victory that we feel like we keep on trying to encourage different civil society organizations to also launch their complaints, because we need a well-rounded approach. We need different civil society organizations also saying, we won. We got this greenwashing complaint through. So there is proof to say there's greenwashing. So now what are you going to do, government? You know?
Inspiring. I have to bang the table on that one. Congratulations to you and the team for accomplishing that. You deserve this. So you have now set a precedent where other organizations can go and lodge greenwashing complaints with the South African Advertising Regulatory Body. Because initially, if I'm hearing you correctly, initially the ruling was that from this body, you submitted a complaint that what TotalEnergy is claiming, given their partnership with South African National Parks, is greenwashing, and you submitted the complaint, and the initial ruling was that it's greenwashing on the sustainable development side, but it's not necessarily greenwashing in terms of environmental protection. And then the marketing team from Total Energy South Africa tried to appeal the sustainable development side. And in trying to do that, they shot themselves in the foot by revealing the extent of the greenwashing. And so you were able, as Fossil Free South Africa, you were able to not only win the sustainable development side, but you were also in a position to demonstrate that even this claim of environmental protection, is that correct?
It is correct. It is
correct. Congratulations.
And I must say that it took a lot of work because we didn't think they would appeal it. And we were sitting thinking, should we appeal, should we not? And I did an interview with French radio, and we had a lot of media in the Financial Times. There were a lot of media around this. And I think that's what hit home with Total Energies, is that French radio is their headquarters. So it was reported now on their home turf, which is why it's important to have a multi-layered approach and not just one approach to this. Because again, not a lot of people know when greenwashing is happening, which is why that extended, or rather expanded, definition is important. And taking this work and putting it in front of the faces of policymakers, fossil fuel companies, the media, and civil society is so important.
So how big is your team? And how big is your ads campaign team at Fossil Free South
Africa?
You
will laugh, Andani, you will laugh, but I believe it's because we have superpowers. But we're a pretty small team. We're a pretty small organization. Nothing above about 20 to 25 employees. And the Fossil Ad Ban is basically myself as the campaign manager and a campaigner. So it's two of us. And we are supported by our director, David Lepage. But honestly, the Fossil Free South Africa works like a family. So whoever's got hands on deck on what, we all jump on it as much as we can. We did also have a lot of help from external sort of consulting bodies. Like, we did consult legal perspectives or legal experts to say, can this complaint hold weight? But we are a pretty small organization. We are also we're a lean team.
Did these legal experts provide their services pro bono, or did you have to raise funds to pay them?
I am not sure. It was before I joined the organization, but I do think there was a fee. We actually did pay. We had to raise funds to pay for that, yes.
Okay. So we have a precedent there. Now, before we go back to the layers you presented here in the beginning, do you think these companies are bribing our politicians and policymakers?
Ooh, I can't say much on that. I'm an evidence-based person. But I can say that because of the presence of corruption in Africa and in our country, I mean, we had a whole state capture commission that went on for years and cost us 14 billion rand. We've had a lot of cases that prove, even from COVID, we still have cases that have disappeared. Where politicians and politicians' family members have spent so much money that should have gone to the people. So I will say, because of the presence of corruption, we can't say that there are no bribes. We can't say that things are not just disappearing. When civil society, communities, and other policymakers come up and they say, listen, this is what we need to look into.
Yes, you know, and I will take another controversial line and go back to our favorite president here, just also while clarifying, this is not Lazola's view, or this is not Fossil Free South Africa's view. But, you know, for me, I think bribery can also come in the form of gifts, positions. For example, in the alcohol ban case, Cyril Ramaphosa was the chairman of South African breweries. And so he was getting not only a lot of financial rewards as chair, but also a large stake in shares, which is dependent on sales. And so it really wouldn't have been in his favor for him to support this ad ban, right? And this kind of paradox that we have is sometimes what leads to this resistance or, you know, this apathy by our policymakers and politicians. From my end, I do believe in terms of those kind of incentives, they are being bribed. And I say that as a professor in business ethics. Okay. So with that being said, we have now covered the top tier.
You know,
I understand. Now I'm clear here on the government, the government side. Now let's take it a step down. Your FAB campaign, which is fossil ad banning campaign, also targets municipalities. Yeah. Why so?
Specifically because of bylaws. Bylaws can actually assist. It would be easier to pass an ad ban at a municipal or city level. Just so we could see it work and present it to the government, and also to see it manifest at a community level so we can connect the dots, right? And bylaws being passed at a municipal level also hold fossil fuel companies accountable. They hold people accountable. So we target municipalities also because a lot of the times they will have to implement these the fossil ad ban. They would have, even if there's a national one, but it will have to trickle down, and the municipalities would have to implement it at city level and at human level, right? So we target them also because they do form a very big part. And I'll say in terms of South African politics, they form a very big part of realizing policies and enacting policies. Because sometimes you find the national government passes a policy, but it gets stuck at municipal level. And when it gets stuck at municipal level, it's stuck everywhere. Nothing is working, right? So that's why it's important for municipalities to be taken into the fold.
How does it get stuck? What do you mean it gets stuck? Because if it's passed at a national level, how can it get stuck?
Yes. Since a lot of the municipalities in our country, in South Africa, are going through bankruptcy, for lack of a better word. A lot of them actually don't have money to, or rather there are millions missing. And you find that then, for a very basic example, is that you find that communities then have no access to water, they have no access to electricity, you don't know what's going on, there's money missing, right? So the corruption that trickles down, that would be a hard stop, right, that trickles down into municipalities, can actually cause a hard stop. So if we're saying there should be a fossil ad ban, those municipalities need to understand what a fossil ad ban is, how would they enact it. If we're going to say fossil fuel companies should not say that they support sustainable development, a billboard in the city of Cape Town, which is one of the top tourist attractions in the world, should not have an ad that says we support environmental protection. And if it does, the municipality would then have to step in to say, listen, you've broken a bylaw. Rather than us having to run all the way to President Cyril Ramaphosa through many channels and saying, in the city of Cape Town, the fossil ad ban policy has been breached. So how long would those two, right? This is why municipalities are so important. Because remember, the fossil ad ban is not just for surface level. It's not just a conversation, or rather meant to feed into the high level conversation of the just transition. It is meant to literally speak to taking away social licensing that fossil fuel companies have over communities and consumers. So it has to then affect the everyday person, and the everyday policymakers are the municipalities.
What do you mean by social license?
So what happens is that
A good example is that if a Total Energies rather has a ad that is geared toward, we want a brighter future, we support environmental protection and all these environmental claims, right? It creates an idea in the mind of the consumer that this company is actually worried about the climate crisis, that this company is actually doing something about the climate crisis. And this is through the ads and the imagery. There's your scientists, techno salvation is being just blasted all over. We have images of solar panels. We have images of wind turbines. And in the mind of the consumer, myself as a consumer included, you're thinking, oh my goodness, they're making investment toward renewable energy. They're trying to improve the planet. And what happens? Whenever a project by Total Energies is brought up or by your Shell to do another seismic survey in South Africa, you're thinking, but they're doing that for our health. That's actually good for us. And then projects start getting passed easier without communities actually interrogating what these companies bring to the fore. Already in the consumer's mind, they're thinking this company is good for my environment and for me. So there's not a lot of convincing that these fossil fuel companies then need to do already in the mind of even the policymaker, because greenwashing goes that far. They're thinking if we deal with Total Energies, we're good. We're moving in the path of renewables energy, for instance, right? So that's your social licensing. And then what then the ripple effect is an increased number of permits that are passed to fossil fuel companies to continue mining the natural resources of the country. We then begin to see communities that challenge these permits that are being given out as though they are anti-progress, anti-technology and moving forward and bringing South Africa into a better place. So the social licensing that is given through greenwashing is, it actually plays a big role in terms of stopping or continuing the extractivist nature that fossil fuel companies follow in countries.
That gives us insight, right? Because what you're saying there is that the reason why you're targeting ads in the first place is because these ads and this greenwashing convinces consumers and community members and even policymakers that these organizations are pro just energy transition, pro environmental protection, and what this creates is an actual support, and if not support, a lack of resistance to what they're what they're doing. So I think that this is really important. Now, are you targeting regional or district municipalities or local municipalities at the city town?
We're targeting first local, because it's easier to speak to these. They're reachable. And the other thing is that what we must understand when dealing with politicians and policymakers is that it's difficult to reach them. And I don't know if this is the story of the global north, but I know, having been in civil society, social justice and campaigning for over 8 years, that it is difficult to reach these people. If you are not going to their houses and knocking their door down and getting arrested, you're not getting anything done, right? So your locality leaders and policymakers then become key, because they're easier to reach. The departments, they're not, it's not like 1+1=2. It's still hard, but you can reach them easier versus the national, right? From there, we then move on with the support of your town councils, your town, your city policymakers, to your legislative policymakers. There, the fossil ad ban is then palatable, because we have members from their inner circle that have heard about it, they understand it, and we can have a conversation going forward.
So on the local level, it's the social licensing you're targeting in order to support the bylaw policy making at the legislative level within municipalities. Is that, did I get you correctly there?
You definitely got it right there. You definitely, because also the talk of municipalities is that of the people. And this can It's mm-hmm. either true or false, but it is, they are the front facing government body with human beings and the and society of South Africa every single day. So the conversation is on the people. And when you present something that says, listen, this is what's actually happening to your people, a better conversation can be had.
Mm-hmm. So are these local municipalities, even district and regional municipalities, do they derive any revenue from advertisement, or is that a purely private enterprise? So these billboards, are any of them owned by these municipalities and a source of revenue for them, or is advertising in any way levy or minor, you know, fee that these municipalities get as a source of revenue on
that
this
advertising?
That
would be difficult to track, Andani. That would be difficult because high rate of corruption and a really cracked down system of administration makes it very difficult to track exactly how much, if any, the municipalities would make from adverts, you know. But so far in our conversations, we haven't had a municipality say, oh, but we're making this amount of money or a percentage from these ads. We have not had any kind of inkling toward that.
Mm, and so when you engage in these discussions at the municipal level, have you had any companies that own, for example, these billboards and that own these advertising dissemination outlets, let me say, come and complain about what you're doing or push back in any way? Or do you guys operate guerrilla, you know, like in silence? Such
A lot of the conversations are in the beginning stage. And remember, like I said, a lot of the leadership in our country is more senior people. So a lot of, and even for some people that aren't exactly senior, these concepts are new. So instead of just arriving and pitching what we're talking about, we have to have a conversation on what policies have been passed on the just transition from a municipal level. Then bring an added tier of greenwashing. Then we need to collectively define and identify the problem. So, and then we move on to, hey, this is a solution that we have. What do you think? But so far, we have not had any complaints from any of these ads. Like I said, Fossil Free is fairly new. So I think that might be one of the factors behind that. I don't expect that we won't have any opposition from Fossil Fuel, from these companies, the ad companies as well.
Okay, so this is a great strategy, because if I have to use an example, the city of Cape Town was hit with a water crisis, and so they had to pass bylaws on water consumption, but those bylaws did not apply to the city of Tshwane, Pretoria, formerly Pretoria. They did not apply to the city of Johannesburg. But they applied to the city of Cape Town. So the moment you entered the jurisdiction of the city of Cape Town, you had this law of water consumption you had to honor. Likewise with energy, the city of Cape Town, I know, are incentivizing people who have excess energy from solar panels and renewable. They are incentivizing them to feed the grid, and they will buy from them. But that is a city of Cape Town policy. It's not necessarily a policy in Ekurhuleni, for an example, and the city of Johannesburg. Do I have you clear?
100%. This is why I keep on emphasizing a multi-layered approach. We can't just go to the city of Cape Town and stick there. We need to spread ourselves thin and speak to the different municipalities. This is also why we have a draft policy to say, hey, this is what we're thinking. And this is also why the policy does not just end at a municipal level, but it goes up to a national level so that we can have uniformity in the conversation or rather policy around greenwashing.
I see you. This multi-layered approach. I mean, again, you know, it's baffling to me that a team of two, of course, with the help of the rest of the organization and external stakeholders, could be operating like this. what does a day in a life, or a week in a life, or even a month in a life, but I wouldn't take it beyond that, look like for Lazola? How do you manage your time? How do you have this kind of reach with a team, you know, of two? Because I'm, you know, I'm saying this because other civil society organizations or teams of one, two, three. Okay. Well, in South Africa, the minimum is three, but that's about it, you know, and they also want to make an impact, and not just in South Africa, but all the way around the global South and BRICS nations. Well, it seems like you are highly stressed. But really a day in a life, a week in a life, a month in a life of Lazola as a campaigns ad manager, in a small team that has to raise funds, do all of this stuff. What does it look like?
Very busy. The truth of the matter is, very busy. But what I have learned over the years being, a campaigner, because I was once a campaigner as well, and I was once a junior campaigner, and I am at heart an activist, is that I cultivate clear networks and relationships, and I cultivate and I nurture these relationships so that the work that the other person does, the other organization, the work that I do can spread, right? I would say I think African approach to working with different organizations and different people. And that's been the backbone of getting us this far, is that we all sit around a table and we say, okay, who knows who in which space, and how can we work together to amplify the campaign? How can we work together to create synergies, right? There are different conversations where you can't just show up and say greenwashing and this is the issue and let's do this, where you can partner and say greenwashing actually is an act that suspends renewable energy solutions in Africa. Then you start partnering with different organizations that are speaking about renewables energy. A lot of our work, a lot of my work is connecting the dots, because I believe in a full-bodied approach when it comes to the just transition. I don't think we can get very far working in silos. So I try my best not to work in a silo. I also think that big corporations get to us, civil society activists, because we work in silos. They can target one person, they can target one organization, but they can't target all of us saying the same thing. They can't target an entire document that speaks about fair finance, that speaks about renewables energy solutions, that speaks about greenwashing, etc., all of it. They can't target that. So a month in my life is juggling emails, calls, and pushing to include Fossil Free South Africa, the ad ban campaign, in conferences, in conversations, in coalitions, to ensure that there is a multi-layered approach, there is a multi-thematic area approach to the just transition. So it's very busy. It's very busy.
Do you experience burnout?
I do have times of burning out, but the truth of the matter is the team, there might be two of us, but we leverage between each other very well. We know who is good at what, and we often go toward what we're good at, but we are also not shy to train each other in what the other's not good at and exchange, right? We tap each other in and out. And I think my team is very honest about, listen, I'm at burnout stage, or I'm very tired. Let's pivot. Let's prioritize what we're going to do this month. Clear work plans help us very much. Then we know that in the next 2 months, this is what we're focusing on. When we're done with this, we tick it. If it has not happened, how do we partner it with the next priority that is in this next 2 months? So planning has been my best friend. I also don't just work. I am not the type of person. I can work at a park. I can work while walking. There are different ways I believe you can collect content and disseminate content. And I engage in those systems to avoid burning out, because having been an activist, I think I've been through so many burnouts in my family. I'm famous for burnouts. I'm the burnout girl. So I've learned, and I make sure whoever I work with and whoever's in my team, I share these types of tactics to ensure that you don't get burnout. If you need to tap out, step back, tap out. Let's see what we can do right now. And that proved quite prudent when it came even to the greenwashing complaint, even to the report launch. You know, if we have to move dates back, we move them back, right? Because rather you produce the best of what you can put out than just a mere meh and put it out there and hope for the best.
Okay, I see you know, streamlining, prioritizing, but most important, being human and you know, recognizing that well-being is important. So the style that you're using, I think we can all learn from. There's a lot of burnout in the space because there's so much work to be done and there's not enough human capital. There's not enough people to do it, right? So there's lots of burnout across the space, but I think to the listeners listening to this, prioritizing well-being actually has greater returns than just incessantly working and being competitive with one another and fizzling out. Now, one of the things that stood out to what you were saying is that I take an African approach. And what I would say there is that the 17th Sustainable Development Goal is partnerships for the SDGs. The idea of partnerships and collaborations is not new to the Global North. In fact, the Global North have been pushing this idea of collaboration, multi-stakeholder initiatives and partnerships for good. So, you know, when you say you take an African approach, what do you mean and how is it different?
I think the ideas in the Global North when it comes to partnership is just that. It's called partnership. You do A, I do B, we keep it moving. When I say I use a more African approach, I mean the words that I used when I described it was I nurture these networks. It does not end when I leave an organization. Mm-hmm. Hi, Andani. Our way of communicating and working with each other is very differently. What solidarity means to us is different to what solidarity means with the Global North organizations, right? And I've experienced this while working in the trenches and working with different organizations in the Global South and the Global North, right? So when I say nurture, I mean that just because it does not speak to exactly greenwashing, it does not mean as an activist that is in the environmental space, I will not show up for the next organization or the next project. If a renewables energy sort of protest is happening outside Total Energies, I'm not going to say, because on the speech in front of everyone, they're not going to talk about greenwashing, I'm not going to show up. I will show up. This is what I mean. There is a culture in the Global North of keeping to your job description, full stop. But what I've experienced in the movements in Africa in general is that we don't just keep to the job description. Our jobs mean our lives. And this is why I also believe that it's different from the Global North and the Global South. So those networks for me, or rather partnerships, are not just partnerships and networks. For me, those are human beings. Someone can call me and say, Laz, there's an issue at this community. People are being forcefully removed. Can you help? I can say I can't show up, but I know of a different movement-based or community organization or group of people that can show up for you. So that's what I mean when I say cultivating and nurturing these partnerships. And it's proven to be extremely helpful because you don't know what expert you can run into as you're doing this level of network building or partnerships building.
So who, you know, if you are at liberty to mention them, who has formed part of this network that has been helping you to achieve the aims of FAB, which is the fossil ad ban?
We are included in Don't Gas Africa.
There is a coalition that we also sit in and we participate in. The Fair Finance Coalition, we also sit on. And there are different organizations that we rely on there. We work very closely with Clean Creatives as well. They're basically a sister organization. So those are a few that I can definitely say we leverage those partnerships, or rather expertise of individuals within those teams, to say, can you take a look at this? Can we partner up? What can we do together to push the just transition? Yeah.
Mm. Now, you mentioned earlier on that, you know, you've been an activist, you've been a campaigner, and now you are an advertising campaign manager. So what is the difference between these three? What's the difference between an activist, a campaigner, and an advertising campaign?
This is a personal question, because I don't believe I can speak for everyone who's walked the path that I'm walking. But for me, I'm going to expose myself. But my activism started like at university level. I went to Rhodes. I participated in Fees Must Fall, name dropping myself. But that looked different to when I became a campaigner, because as an activist, a lot of people expect you to be on the ground, never tired. You're always going through burnouts. You're always the first respondent, right? And a true activist, no matter how far up or rather sideways or linear or horizontal you go, that never dies within you. This is why I'm saying people can call me and be like, Les, this is what's happening. And it's got nothing to do with my job, right? But then moving on to being a campaigner, and in between then I was a researcher, specifically in the monitoring and evaluations sector, looking at social justice campaigns and if they're actually working in communities. How do you ensure that a project or a civil society or approach actually is impactful to the lives of everyday human beings, right? And the difference or the jump is that I kept my activism alive. I think I was protesting even as a researcher. I showed up at different protests. because they, like I said, in the global South, it means your life. You know, if it's a GBV protest, I'm a woman. It means something huge to me. You know, environmental, I'm a human being. It means something to me. And the jump to being a campaigner, then I think for me, that's where my eyes were opened to different thematic areas. Because before then, I worked in the sexual reproductive health rights and GBV and women empowerment sector. And when I moved on, I kind of then saw, oh my goodness, there are so many connections between the environmental, service delivery, corruption, political, and what I've already done. So for me, campaigning taught me to connect the dots. I started connecting the dots, right? Having studied political and international relations, I had the theory. Now I was moving around the praxis, and it looked different because I could protest, but now I was also in a position to say, how about I start a protest? How about I initiate a conversation with a policymaker and the communities, instead of saying, let's stand outside a building and protest, let's get ourselves in the room. And by then, I'd learned enough to get communities, myself, different organizations in the room. Now, being a campaign manager, it's all of these, because I'm still an activist, included, but it is also about nurturing and building. Now I have a good opportunity to take all of these networks that I have come across. Some I've been in, some I've not been, some I've been looking from the outside. Now I can actually build a willing, able, ready, and impartial toward the Global South networks, right? Now I can be part of saying, okay, guys, we do greenwashing. You do renewables energy solutions. You are doing renewable energy solutions practically on the ground. What can we create together to ensure that we actually have a just transition? You know, now from all of those lessons learned, you can take it up to the policymaker to say, this is what's been created. These are communities, people, academics that are behind it. What are you going to do about it? So it's an incorporation of all of those.
Very interesting. Hey, the university activism space is like a you know, like a barrack, you know, like a training ground for future activists. I know personally, I was a student representative council member at the University of Fort Hare. And we similar to Fees Must Fall that you spoke about, we were fighting against unreasonable increases in fees. We were not backing down, and we as a collective were banned from campus. Now, that was quite scary because, we had, including myself, people with future aspirations who wanted to finish our degrees, but we were banned from campus, right? So we couldn't attend classes. Fees Must Fall, the Fees Must Fall movement, had heavy consequences for young people that participated. But whether fees must fall or not, what has been the scariest consequence you've ever faced for protesting in your career?
Ooh, in my career, definitely fees must fall tops it, because I was just a political international relations student. I just wanted to go to the UN, change the world, and have policies passed, and be a diplomat, right? That was the first fear I got when a whole university can put together a list of 14 people. I was one of them, to say these are the instigators that started Fees Must Fall. This puts us in the public domain. It was a book this thick, right? And my second fear that's partnered with this was when I joined the Right to Know, and there was a lot of protesting, access to information organization. And we realized through the Secrecy and Surveillance Department that our images had been stored, and mine from Fees Must Fall. So AI was being used to identify the instigators and problematic, not just students this time around, but civilians. Because then I'm not just a student. At this point, I'm a member of the South African society. That, for me, the culmination of those moments and the realization was very scary for me, because I had to sit back and ask myself questions about my safety in general. Do I continue? And also remembering that I'm not alone. I'm bringing people with me. Every time I'm doing something, there's somebody new, there's somebody that looks up to the work that you're doing. You're bringing them with you. Can I handle that? Can I bring more people? Can I bring more of myself? And I think that was the scariest moment, because I then started thinking, if I'm not this person, if I'm not working in the social justice sector, if I'm not still moving toward being a public diplomat, that's not just thinking about the final policy, but actually understands and has dealt with the people that will be affected by global policies, who else will I be? And I think that was a scary moment. That was a very scary moment for me, because for me, at a deeper level, there was a question of, is it myself or is it a safer somebody else I don't know? And needless to say, I'm still here. So it's clear who I chose.
I want to salute you. Kudos to you, my sister. Kudos to you. Just on this issue of AI and facial recognition, do you think in the global South this is a practice that is happening against advocates? And what would be your message to activists and advocates of social regeneration, environmental regeneration, energy regeneration for good? Is this a widespread practice, facial recognition, storing images and details, ID numbers and stuff of activists? And what would you suggest as a response to that, to all those on the front line across the global South?
I definitely have seen it be a widespread approach. I've seen it be a widespread approach, not just in South Africa, but different activists within Africa are actually noticing this, right? They are noticing what is happening in terms of their images. And also in subtle moments, when you have moved on from protesting and you run into someone that could have never been at that protest or seen your face, and they say, oh, I know you. You're the troublemaker. Right? And a lot of activists have experienced this in university spaces when we are busy now applying for master's, PhD. They're like, oh, we know you. You're the troublemaker. Or even in government level, when you meet a minister for the first time, they're like, I know you. You're the troublemaker. Right? And this is not just my story. A lot of activists have faced it. And what I'm going to advise is something that I've seen activists start using or rather doing already. Partner up. Partner up with civil society organizations that look at and rather assist legally. Don't let it go. There have been reports that have been published repeatedly on AI and images being used. Partner up, interrogate these statements, and look at the different organizations and people that you know and see how you can get assistance. Because what needs to be understood is that we can't keep demonizing activists. As a society, we are where we are because of activists. And this is not just from Fees Must Fall. This is not just apartheid. This is eons of human existence has been from activists. Partner up with legal representatives, partner up with organizations that actually support activist work. And this is activist methods. An example in South Africa is Your Right to Protest, KELS. KELS also works from a legal perspective to support activism, right? Partner up with these different organizations. Don't go out on your own. That was the biggest lesson I learned, is that do not go out on your own and protest. Make sure you've got backup. Because the sad thing is, governments and policymakers have gotten good at AI. They've gotten good at misinformation, misrepresenting what activists stand for. They've gotten away with getting to a point of harming activists. And we saw it with the protests in Uganda against the crude oil pipe. We've seen it. Those actors, some are in jail, some have been physically harmed, and they were protesting for their lives. And what I would also want to say is a word of encouragement. Being an activist is not wrong. You're not a rascal. And that is how activists are treated. You're not a rascal. Mm. Activism has fueled human progression for many years. It has fueled human progression. Activism is being active in what you're doing. And that has fueled human evolution for many years. And therefore, what we're doing is not new and it's not wrong. That's what I would say.
What happened? What happened in Uganda with this oil, crude oil pipe? I mean, you know, you don't have to go into details. Now you've sparked my curiosity.
Activists were basically protesting against, apparently it is the largest crude oil pipe in Africa or in the world. And they were protesting against it actually happening. And they were protesting against the violations that are occurring, because that is further, obviously, fossil fuel company extractivism that is happening. So that means further harmfulness to the environment and to human rights and to human mortality, essentially. So activists were protesting. And what actively happened is that police was discharged on activists, and a lot of them were arrested. A lot of them were physically harmed. This, unfortunately, is not new in the African context, right? And this is just me summarizing a larger issue. It's not new, but that is how activism and that is how activists are received. And sadly, by governments, because this was not done by fossil fuel companies. Or directly, let me rather say. But it's from governments. This is how governments respond to activists that are trying to push their society along.
So I think you gave a good example. And I think activists can take a lot from your life experience in the Ugandans there. And it's important to just remember that this is a high stakes game. But like you said, through networking and intelligent partnerships, your voice becomes amplified. Now, you know, as we slowly fade out, I want to go back to when you were giving us your day in a life, a day in a week in a month. You mentioned the importance of prioritization. So we were still at the municipal level. Which municipalities are you currently targeting or prioritizing with FAB?
City of Cape Town, definitely, because it is a big municipality, and also because there have already been networks formed through other areas of fossil-free South Africa through our divestment campaign. They already work in communication with the City of Cape Town, or rather strategies around that. We're also essentializing the municipality of Albert Luthuli, which is where the community of Carolina also exists, and the majority of the mines exist. Specifically because that municipality, we have had a conversation with, they were pretty keen to continue the conversation, and they understood from a human level the effects of greenwashing, and how a lot of the times, even municipalities and leadership within communities lose control of how far fossil fuel companies go when it comes to extractivism versus the impacts to community members. We have also had conversations that have trickled into a Ekurhuleni municipality, and we are definitely beginning larger conversations with the Gauteng municipality as well, the city of Johannesburg, I mean.
Right, so city of Johannesburg and Gauteng, Ekurhuleni is in Mpumalanga, right?
Ekurhuleni is in the east of Johannesburg.
It's in the east. It's east of Joburg. I'm being exposed here now. Albert Luthuli is where?
Albert Luthuli is in Mpumalanga.
It's in Mpumalanga. Okay. So if you had to rank all of those in terms of priority, and City of Cape Town, of course, in the Western Cape. So
yes.
If you had to rank all of those in terms of priority, you know, which would be top, like this, you know, and we're not going to hold you to it. You can just shoot from the hip. You know, it's not an official ranking.
I think, so how I rank in terms of prioritizing, I rank in terms of sad word that I will use, but winnability. This comes from campaign's background, but who can I speak to, or rather, which municipality can actually get this, and we can collaborative, and who can I do that with on a faster, I guess, for lack of a better word, faster pace? And I would say the Albert Luthuli municipality, because we've had the conversations, they've seen the pledge that we encourage endorsers to sign, to say we will not partner with fossil fuel companies. We support the fossil ad ban at a municipal and national level, and then we continue the conversation. So I would say Albert Luthuli, also because they are hardest hit by the existence of fossil fuel companies at a community level. And then City of Cape Town, definitely, because there's a lot of policies or bylaws, let me rather say, that have been passed to combat certain environmental effects that the citizens of Cape Town have felt. And Johannesburg, specifically the city of Johannesburg, because they also have a progressive just transition, I'll say on paper-based kind of approach, already having the conversations. So it would be good when we come in, we're rather adding a layer of greenwashing and we're having a conversation moving forward. So yeah. Don't hold me to that ranking at all.
No, we won't. Neither you nor Fossil Free South Africa. The hardest hit community is the Mpumalanga community, where you spoke about the mines and their impact. And I want us to end with that. But in terms of, you know, City of Cape Town, Ekurhuleni, you know, near Johannesburg and Gauteng, and others that you mentioned, what are the impacts on community now? You know, we've dealt with the policy, we've dealt with the municipal bylaw policy level. So let's go down to the communities. we know Mpumalanga's coal and other mining activity, but in these other municipalities, mm-hmm. what impacts and effects of greenwashing and actual sufferings that our communities are facing?
Yeah, I mean, climate change, it's not because it's just happening, you know. There's also been increased changes in the weather. There's been Cape Town fires that are happening. Mm. And in Johannesburg, we have seen repeatedly, I think to a point where nobody talks about this, there's a river called Jaskay River. And when there's heavy rains, it overflows. And there are communities that have built on the bank of the river. And every time that river overflows, those communities are washed out. That's people dying, that's homes being destroyed. And even in the KZN situation, for instance, we have not reached KZN, but we are in the process of doing that. But the KZN floods are a very good example, and we feature the KZN floods in the Smokes and Mirrors quite a lot. And where it links to greenwashing is that the increased amount of projects that South Africa holds of fossil fuel companies are putting us at risk. Do you know that South Africa is the 14th biggest CO2 emitter?
In the world, and the thing
about this, in the world.
14th biggest in the world.
That much.
Mm.
Yeah. And we hold that much because of, we give so many permits, any type of mining, seismic surveys. And this is also because in South Africa, we don't only look at extractivism or fossil fuel companies from a petroleum perspective. It's petroleum, it's coal, it's oil. And it is also the level of extractivism that we see in the oceans. So that's a whole different perspective. And that's where your Cape Town and Durban come in, is that the coastal areas are at risk. Coastal biodiversity has degraded to a large amount because of seismic surveys, you know? Mm. So we also have, I think it's Secunda, which is the largest coal plant in the world. Mm. So these types of things are not, these are projects that the government is proud of because apparently there's electricity access, but in essence, we still have a lot of load shedding. So that's not a fact. But these are projects that are workshopped and presented as being progressive in nature. But the truth of the matter is they are degrading our environment and our human lives. Right. It's not going in the direction that is consistently being workshopped globally and country level. And even normal citizens are just like, none of this is helping us. None of these projects are helping South Africans out. We are still left in rolling blackouts. Many businesses have shut down due to load shedding. Many mm-hmm. businesses are hanging on by a thread because of load shedding and COVID. Right. Mm-hmm. Hospitals are having to beg for solars and generators. Hospitals, like literally hospitals where people are in ICU and they're dying, they are also in situations whereby the government can say, okay, we won't have blackouts with this hospital, with this region. So all of these efforts are not necessarily helpful, but they are workshopped as though they are helpful, right?
Mm. Mm. Yeah. I see you. Now let's go to Mpumalanga, which is a big... Which is a big, you know, concern in terms of energy, because there are a lot of coal mines there. And as you know, in the South African energy and electricity sector, we use a lot of coal in our largely coal-fired energy production plants. And so these coal mines are hailed as the source of our national energy grid. On the other hand of that, how do we say, that sort of green washing of these mines, what is really happening to community members on the ground? What are they really suffering? And, you know, what has FAB observed in going to the ground and engaging them?
So a lot of the things I'm going to say are also on our websites and socials, because we actually have video footage of community members speaking. So I'm quoting as I'm speaking.
Okay.
So when we went to the communities, what we found was that, one, there is no thorough disclosure from fossil fuel companies about the effects of their extractivist nature on the community. So there isn't a thorough explanation on how it will affect the air, how it will affect the community in terms of their health, in terms of mortality, right? And community members have consistently been in situations whereby there's an increase in respiratory issues. Children are being born with respiratory issues, which are directly linked through other studies that have been released when it comes to Carolina community to the existence of these mines, right? Mm-hmm. Two, communities have spoken countless times when we went there and we had this conversation about how mining rights are actually in opposition to their heritage land rights. And by this, I mean, a lot of the mines, the community members actually don't know where the mines are getting the right to mine on their land. So Mpumalanga is very much traditional chief-led, right? So a lot of the land rights still very much belong to the people versus the government. So when you move onto a specific territory, there's a multi-layered conversation you have to have with the chief, the community, the government, and you as a fossil fuel company, right? So community members are losing their rights and they're losing their land. And that's the first layer of losing their land and losing their rights to their land. The second layer is that a lot of these companies, because there's no clear systems on the existence and non-existence of these mines, is that what we're actually told is that one day you will literally wake up and there's a mine. And then 3 months later, the mine is gone. And there has been no covering up the hole. There's been no covering up of anything. It's just left bare as is. And this then means that I remember one of the participants said, as it rains, all of that poison is then driven into water streams. And I think we can then put together the ripple effects of that, right? This is now dumping, you know? Mm. And remember, Mpumalanga is a predominantly agricultural charged province. So people need the land to survive. People need the land for jobs. So you found a lot of people in the workshop that we ran that ended up unemployed because there was basically contaminated water running through a water project that they were a part of. And there's nothing anyone can do. It's contaminated water. And the project is built in the channel line of the contaminated water because that was the water source. So thousands lose their jobs, right? Mm-hmm. Another very disturbing fact was the labor laws that are constantly being violated, because when the mines disappear, nobody's getting paid and nobody knows who to call or who to go to get paid. Another thing is that a lot of the personnel that work on the mines, specifically the coal mine, I remember they had said, don't have proper protective gear. There is a clip of someone literally describing just a normal like mask, and it means in that mask, you're inhaling carbon dioxide until you get dizzy and woozy. This is something they described. Mm. And then you remove your mask and you breathe. But the problem with that is that you're shoveling coal, right? You're shoveling coal and you remove your mask to not breathe carbon dioxide, but you are literally breathing the black smoke of the coal that you're shoveling. Mm. And so again, we have Ishley passing away. Men, fathers, sons passing away, right? And then we have women trying to go work on the mine, and apparently it's difficult for women to actually get employment on any of these mines. A lot of the times you also find that, there seems to be a struggle between
who to employ. Because also remember, a lot of the jobs that are being readily available are not the jobs that are promised. Like they'll come into a community, they say, we will employ this community, we're opening a mine. But what they actually mean is that they'll take the community members and basically give them jobs shoveling coal. So a lot of them women don't necessarily apply for that kind of job, right? And at the same time, another issue that was raised was the fact that a lot of these mines then get left behind, and even chiefs have to fight to say, you actually cannot open a mine, or when the mine owners and people that run the offices in the mine have disappeared, chieftaincies have to start working with the government to find out who was there, what was happening. There are no reparations, and these community members are just left on the receiving end consistently. So those are just a few of the issues that these community members are facing. And the biggest issue that we realized in terms of greenwashing is the initial conversation. The initial conversation between a fuel company and whoever they're talking to, because apparently they hold small meetings with certain select people who are not a lot of the times the right leaders of the community that should be giving rights for mining, right? They're having these conversations, and there is where the greenwashing happens. That's where they say, we are going to give you jobs. That's where they're saying, we are going to donate this amount of money to bursaries. And this is also where the corporate social investment comes in. This is not from the goodness of their heart, but it is presented as so, right? This is where imagery is portrayed, because if you see any adverts, right, when it comes to fossil fuel companies, you see, again, I'll say this again, your solars, you see your wind turbines, you see the technology and how they want the future. And so whoever they are speaking to will say, actually, I know this company from the radio and the TV. Because when we ran the smokes and mirrors data, it was on across all of these platforms, radio, TV, and different commercial radio stations and commercial TV. And they will feel like, actually, I can trust the Total Energies. I can trust the Sasol because they actually want what's good for me. Right. And when these mines then start happening, each of these communities don't know what was promised, who to hold accountable, or what is actually going on. And then the mines disappear and nobody's gotten paid. People have wasted their lives. So this is where greenwashing is extremely important, is that you can hold these companies accountable, even at a community level, as to what they promise, what they say they're doing versus what it is that they do to the environment.
Power. I hear you. I really, really hear you on this one. And it's so, so, so important when a mother gives birth to a sick or deformed child, and it is coal mining for coal-fired energy power plants that has led to this effect. Now, when one is faced with this situation, I am completely blown away at what you said in terms of the possibility of a mine mining for 3 months. How, I mean, mining requires heavy, heavy equipment and infrastructure. How is it possible that a mine can mine for 3 months and disappear? I personally have never heard of this.
We had the same experience. I mean, we had the same experience when we heard this, but the thing is that we did site visits. And we realized that, you see, what we call mining is infrastructure showing up there and buildings and, but what we're actually seeing is just digging in the path of nature and people. And it's sold as though we are here to open a mine. Right? So again, so many definitions are clouded in limited, in a limited definition, because then what is mining? Because the communities are saying that, because when these companies come into communities, they say, we're opening a mine, there are jobs. What so-and-so hears in the streets is that there are jobs up the hill. There's a mine opening. People go, they work at a mine, they sign agreements that they have not been given enough time to read through, that they have not been given enough legal expertise or understanding, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they are working. And then 3 to 4 months down the line, the mine is closed. And when they read their contract, it's not even an employment contract.
Mm-hmm.
It's got nothing to do with the hours. Not the hours, it's got nothing to do. So this is also one of the things we highlighted when we did the greenwashing complaint with the advertising regulatory body, is that the existence of greenwashing is, it affects people even at a granular level and even at a different level of labor relations in the country.
Lazalagati, this has been such a fulfilling conversation. What would be your closing thoughts to the listeners of this podcast? What would you like to say to them? What is the message you would like to leave them with at the end of the day?
I think one, thank you that there's a platform like this and there are listeners, because obviously if there weren't any listeners, the platform wouldn't be here. Secondly, I would like to encourage them to look up Fossil Free South Africa and actually sign the pledge for a fossil ad ban in South Africa. Because like I said before, many voices can or a few organizations, voices from within and outside of South Africa. And what I can also say is that every person, even if you're in a different sector, climate change affects you. The climate crisis we're facing affects you. Find a way to be involved. It doesn't matter if you're a singer, you're a fashion designer, you're a scientist. It doesn't matter if you're a teacher or if you're a student. Find a way to get involved. There are many organizations. Fossil Free South Africa has volunteered forms where you can actually volunteer your time, and that is the only way we can actually chart a fair and a proper just transition.
Lazalagati, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you for coming aboard the jet. In closing, I have one last request for you to complete the following sentence. I am Lazalagati, and I am a passenger on jet because, and when I say passenger on jet, I don't mean the podcast. I mean, you are a passenger on the Just Energy Transition movement because. So over to you.
All right. I am Lazalagati, and I am a passenger on the jet because I believe in inclusive policymaking. Yeah.
Thanks for tuning into our Jet podcast today. Before you disembark, don't forget to subscribe and stay connected. For more resources, updates, and ways to take action, visit jetvoices.com. Until our next jet flight, stay inspired, stay engaged, and keep pushing for a just energy transition.